from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President-elect Donald Trump has picked ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson as his nominee for Secretary of State. Tillerson, who has spent his whole professional career at Exxon, has close ties to Russian President Vladimir Putin. He's expected to face a skeptical Congress amid bipartisan concerns over Russia's hacking of the U.S. election. Coming up on Foreign, we'll look at Tillerson's record, his likelihood of confirmation, and what his selection signals about a Trump foreign policy. And we'll also bring you analysis of Trump's pick of former Texas Governor Rick Perry as Energy Secretary. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. It's official. Donald Trump has selected ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson for Secretary of State. In a tweet, Trump called Tillerson one of the truly great business leaders of the world who has vast experience at dealing successfully with all types of foreign governments. Tillerson has spent his entire professional career at Exxon, starting as an engineer back in 1975 and becoming CEO in 2006. He also has a history of close business connections with Russian President Vladimir Putin, and GOP Senator Marco Rubio said today that he has serious concerns about Tillerson, who is likely to face a tough confirmation fight because of his ties with Russia. In this hour, we talk about what Tillerson's selection might mean for a whole range of issues, including trade and climate policy and other environmental concerns and America's role in the Middle East. And we'll also discuss Trump's pick for Energy Secretary, former Texas Governor Rick Perry. Joining us here in studio is Antonia Juhas, who is investigative journalist, author of Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Good to have you back with us. Margaret Talev is also with us from Washington this morning, White House correspondent for Bloomberg, and good to have you as well, Margaret Talev. Good morning.
Hi, Michael. Great to be with you.
Yeah, good to have you, and we'll have other people throughout the hour that we're going to be checking with, including a correspondent from the National Review and somebody from Cato. But let me begin first with you, Margaret Talev, and let's talk about just this whole strange procession of people that came to see Trump, including Mitt Romney. One of Trump's close advisors actually said publicly that he believed that was to set just to torture Mitt Romney. At this point, we can only speculate on that. But there were a number of people who went through, including Petraeus, and there was talk about Rudy Giuliani. And what do we know about the process, Huntsman? What do we know about the process that finally settled on Tillerson?
It has been fascinating to watch, and it's so different, of course, from the way most presidents-elect conduct business, but the most current past president-elect, President Obama, whose process was really the opposite. It was very, you know, sort of subtle and a lot of discretion and didn't want leaks. And this has been really the opposite, which is the kind of red carpet walk, you know, through Trump Tower so that everybody can see at least who Trump wanted you to see at the time that he wanted you to see them. And a couple of times it was believed that the list was set, that there were a finalist group of, you know, three or four finalists, Bob Corker, Mitt Romney, David Petraeus, and then Rex Tillerson was the late entry into this game when Trump sort of himself said, well, this isn't really set yet. A couple of factors may be pivotal, may have been pivotal to his thinking and may be pivotal to the way Republicans and leadership process this, but it is that sort of troika of endorsements, right, from Condi Rice, from Jim Baker, and from Bob Gates, really prominent Republicans in the diplomacy and defense world, national security world of the last couple of, you know, of the Bush family.
Prominent Republicans, so, and certainly all worthy of a great deal of respect, but also ties to, well, not only ties to Exxon, but also ties to Rosneft, the Russian oil producer.
Yes, you know, and that's true, and that has come out, but it is not dominating the discussions of this, at least on the Republican side so far, and Republicans control both chambers of Congress, they control the Senate, and partly because of Democrats' actions, the filibuster rules have been weakened, and so this really is a Republican process right now. I mean, Chuck Schumer The Democratic leader has just put out a statement, and it's fairly moderated. It is not guns blazing, we're going to sink this nomination, possibly because they can't, but also because that hasn't been Schumer's style so far. What he says is, while Mr. Tillerson's worldview may not be as dangerously interventionist as John Bolton's or others, it doesn't absolve him from being asked the most serious questions about these relationships with Russia and the Paris Climate Agreement.
Excuse me, we need to talk about John Bolton because he's likely choice for Deputy Secretary of State. But let me just talk about some concern, certainly in the Senate. I mean, John McCain, for example, Senator McCain of Arizona, Republican, has said we've got support for a butcher here. I mean, in effect, a thug, a bully, that is Putin. He tied to Tillerson. And Marco Rubio, as I said in my introduction, has also come out foursquare criticizing and expressing concern about the ties to Putin. I mean, those are going to play a central role in any kind of confirmation, and they could possibly impede a confirmation, couldn't they?
It certainly will complicate the confirmation hearings, but the confirmation hearings is probably, as it is in most cases, where the damage is going to be done. If Mr. Tillerson emerges from this confirmation hearings, it seems very likely that he would be able to move on. So what we don't know yet is how will these confirmation hearings proceed. And Mr. McCain has been somewhat careful, as it became clear that it would be Tillerson, to say he's not trying to attack Tillerson personally, but he's very concerned about Russia and the Russia ties. That's one flank of concern for the Republicans. That's going to be the central flank of concern, and for the Democrats, it is going to be the environment and what the implications of his own personal beliefs and the policies that he's executed on behalf of Exxon are going to mean in terms of things like the Paris deal or any global climate change agreements with nations or policies, whether they're with Russia or in the Caspian area or in the Mideast, that affect oil policy.
What about the fact, we'll talk some more about this with Antonio Yuhas, who's here with us in studio, has done a good deal of investigative digging and has written a great deal about this. But what about the fact that, and we talked about this a bit yesterday with the former Russian ambassador Michael McFaul, there were 20 visits to the White House when President Obama was at the helm by Tillerson, and they were all presumably about the sanctions. If he can't separate himself from Exxon and from Russia, then perhaps we have a real confirmation battle, the likes of which we've never seen. But, of course, he's probably going to go up on the Hill and say, yes, I can separate myself. And people like David Yergin, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author who's written a great deal about oil, says he's going to divorce himself completely from Exxon. He was ready to retire, in fact.
Yeah, so the 20 visits to the White House, which we reported on Sunday, many of these came before the authorization of the new sanctions, about three-quarters of them. So his first 15 visits covered, the waterfront. Don't forget when President Obama took office, there was the 2008 financial crisis. He was having business leaders in. Tillerson was in that group. He was there for the Boy Scouts-related events, for STEM education. So if you put the Russia stuff off to the side for a minute, this is someone who the president himself has met several times. The current president himself has met with several times and felt like was a good ambassador for some of these issues where you want, major CEOs, involved at the helm of a project. But what happened is after the spring of 2014, when the new authorizations for sanctions began, all of those recorded visits that we've seen to the White House were with Jeff Zients, who was the head of the NEC, is the head of the NEC, but already was at the time, and we don't know from Zients directly, but we do know from other sources that the sanctions were discussed in those visits 2014 and going forward.
Margaret Tolov, again with us from Washington, is White House correspondent with Bloomberg, and Antonio Yuhas here in studio is an investigative journalist who is the author of The Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide. And let's get you on record here, if we could, Antonio. I mean, can he separate himself from big oil? His whole life has been essentially his whole career and lifetime with Exxon. Steve Cole said the whole career has been about promoting oil and gas production, and he's done deals with Rosneft, the Russian oil producer. He's going to get up in front of Capitol Hill and say, I can separate myself, can he?
Yeah, I mean, this This isn't just a man who spent his entire life in oil. He's spent his entire life at Exxon. And Exxon is a particularly insular company. It's also the largest and historically most profitable corporation on the planet.
It's almost like a sovereign state, isn't it?
It is very much like a sovereign state. And it has a long history and expectation and experience of dictating policy, both within the U.S. government and internationally. And those the international agenda is extensive and a very, very long history of operations within many foreign governments, including very long and recorded extreme histories of human rights abuses, environmental abuses, participating with some of the most abusive militaries and governments on the planet with just one achieved objective, which is what is good for Exxon. And Tillerson continued that agenda successfully in some cases, but not always successfully, at the head of ExxonMobil. And he's not choosing to retire in March. Exxon has a forced retirement at age 65. It's how basically every CEO goes out because they are all lifers. That's the tradition at Exxon from the beginning. And at 65, he has to leave, and that 65 is next year.
But so, let me ask you about the fact that his predecessor, Lee Raymond, mm-hmm. who he replaced back in 2006, was clearly kind of a climate change denier. He was on the fence about climate change. And in fact, in 2012, Tillerson said it's an engineering problem. It needs an engineering solution. But he's also said, I think the Paris Agreement is something that we can live with and should live with. He's talked about a carbon tax. He says he believes in climate change.
That's great. I'm all for that. The problem is the policies of his company and the policies, both in terms of public policy and the actions of the company, do not reflect a genuine concern. So when we look back at the history of ExxonMobil and its relationship to climate change, you know, very famously investigated by Inside Climate News and Los Angeles Times at this point, that Exxon knew back in 1977 that the actions of humans burning fossil fuels intensified changes and harm within the climate. In 1980, an intern at ExxonMobil figured out that the solution to that problem is that 80% of fossil fuels needed to stay in the ground. Exxon then proceeded to not only spearhead the climate denialist movement, but to actively work for public policy, which stopped the enactment of climate change policies, which meant moving us backwards through policy. Now, if ExxonMobil truly believed in solving climate change through its behavior, one of the things it would do is aggressively move, say, into, you know, clean energy or green energy. ExxonMobil has aggressively done the opposite. One of the least invested in greener alternative energy oil companies out there, and very dismissive towards the idea.
Can you say something? I want to get Jim Garrity on here. We've got him on the line, who's a senior political correspondent for National Review, and hear from him. But you've done a lot of research about the Texas Public Policy Foundation, mm-hmm. and its ties and its connection to Tillerson as essentially a policy mandate or a policy paradigm for them?
Well, not exactly. That's not how I'd say I reported it. So the Texas Public Policy Foundation is emerging as one of the leading think tanks within the Trump administration, which is deeply problematic. Exxon has funded them over the years, as has every major Texas oil company. But the Texas Public Policy Foundation, from which we're already seeing people like Kathleen Hartnett White, who's set to be a key player within EPA, and policy players who have been part of the transition and part of the advisors to Donald Trump on energy policy, are part of this camp, which is Trump's domestic policy team, which is composed primarily in the energy and oil and gas sector of the heads of oil companies that are like Trump, like Harold Hamm. They're the heads of their own primarily fracking, primarily domestically focused fracking businesses. These are people that are really interested in the Bakken in North Dakota and in increasing production in the United States and maintaining our position as the largest oil producer in the world, and in fact doubling the amount of oil that we currently produce in the United States to supersede Saudi Arabia's role. And if you want to see all of this laid out in public policy, I mean in a policy playbook, it's in a book called Fueling Freedom, which two of Trump's advisors co-authored.
Antonio Yuhas here with us in the studio again as investigative journalist and author of The Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide. And I mean, before we go on with this, I want to bring Jim Garrity into this. He's on the line from Virginia. He is senior political correspondent with National Review. And we welcome you, Jim Garrity, to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys for having me.
I'm just looking at a statement. I'd like to get your response from the standpoint of a political correspondent for the National Review. It's from the National Resource Defense Council. It says Trump continues packing cabinet with polluter allies by naming Perry for Energy Department. That, we may recall, was the one department out of the three that he wanted to abolish but couldn't remember. And I'm wondering what your response is to this. I mean, essentially, as many people, particularly here in California, look at it, it's an unqualified individual at war with the central mission of doing something that NRDC has of making sure the pollution does not continue.
I'm stunned that Trump would appoint people the National Resources Defense Council wouldn't like, and I'm stunned they're objecting to it. I think this is kind of pretty much exactly what most people would have expected to play out from late on election night or the morning afterwards. This is an interest group that very much has seen itself as very much a wholehearted believer and an advocate for taking action to combat climate change, and Trump has indicated that sometimes he's a skeptic of it, and that the EPA goes far beyond its mandate and imposes unreasonable costs on government, and you've got this ideological split here. I don't know, no offense to the fine folks of the National Resources and Defense Council, I don't know what they're really going to be able to do about it, since I don't think their arguments are going to carry that much water with the senators up on Capitol Hill. I'd be surprised if any, at this point, I'd be surprised if any of these nominations go down. I think the book is still out on Tillerson, but it's going to take something to really get some of these nominees to shake out Republican senators. At this point, I think you'd have to lay heavy odds for the confirmation of all of them right now.
Although, what about, we were talking earlier about the fact that both Senator McCain and Senator Rubio have spoken out of their concern, not necessarily so much about pollution, but about the ties to Vladimir Putin and about the ties to Russia.
Sure, that one is probably the most fruitful angle so far. Earlier this morning, I looked not knowing much about Rex Tillerson. I think it's one of the things that is, you don't get a lot of genuine surprises in the political world. And I think that, if you'd just gone back 2-3 weeks ago, there was buzz about Romney, there was buzz about Bob Corker, there was buzz about David Petraeus, and really not too much, Rudy Giuliani getting mentioned every now and then. Rex Tillerson really seemed to come out of nowhere. And it was kind of surprising to learn this morning that former Secretary of Defense Bob Gates was the person who apparently first recommended him for the job. To President-elect Trump, that Condi Rice, former Secretary of State and National Security Advisor to President Bush, was the another strong supporter of it. Dick Cheney issued a statement, really. For a guy whose reputation, based on kind of the initial burst of coverage, is that he's this stooge of Putin, these are not the voices I would have expected to come out saying, we love this guy.
Yeah, but forgive me, they are voices that have ties to Exxon and Rosneft, as we said earlier, and one has to at least acknowledge that without impugning them to any degree.
Well, I was about to say, so you really think they're going to sign on to a Putin stooge because Exxon told them to? Come on.
Let's hear from you on this. Let me go to Antonio. I'll come back to you. Antonio, you have?
I think there's clearly a desire to move in the direction of a closer relationship to Vladimir Putin within the Trump administration, and there is an alliance to that viewpoint among these players in the Bush administration. Now, of course, all of the Bush folks were behind Bush moving into this election. Trump was their last choice. I think Tillerson is the person that's being put within this administration to represent, together with Goldman Sachs, the traditional Republican views, traditional Republican establishment. And those views are going to run aggressively counter to the domestic agenda that Trump has set up.
But at the same time, and I'm going to go to you on this if I could, Margaret Tolliver, at the same time, the Trump administration can pretty much say and herald the fact that they're draining the swamp. They're getting people who are not part of the establishment. And in fact, Tillerson has had no governmental experience, but he's not tied to politics in that way and part of the establishment or the institutions.
I think the swamp argument is going to just get set off to the side for a little while. I mean, critics or people who think that some of these nominations or appointments are hypocritical will try to raise it, but I think that is not going to be Trump's focus right now. That was an election focus, and he may go back to it during populist speeches, but this is a matter of setting the tone and the policy structure, right, for a few really important issues. And the one thing that sort of strikes me is that with this pick, it is a signal this pick and also the Rick Perry pick that we expect, it is a signal of a shift away from kind of the experience within that field, right? So you can look at the State Department in a couple of ways, and one is like how much, what's the diplomatic experience you have? Were you in Congress? Did you serve on the Foreign Relations Committee and such? And that has to do a lot with kind of being, having training in the art of political diplomacy. And while Tillerson may certainly arguably have experience in business diplomacy, what he brings is a business worldview, not that sort of foreign relations, national security worldview. And I'm raising this because I think if you look at the Energy Department and that Rick Perry announcement, which we expect to be coming so soon after this, there really is a connection there. If you look at the Energy Department, you look at who Obama has now, Steve Chu, right, a physicist, Nobel Prize winner in physics. The Energy Department deals with nuclear power as well. There are a couple of different ways to look at these appointments, and one is how would you be an ambassador or an effective advocate for American business and the economy? And another is to say, what is your experience in world affairs or in the actual science of energy?
Well, I think you've said it very well. There's a big split here between business and diplomacy in many people's minds. And I want to actually get Jim Garrity on the record here about the Perry appointment in light of the Tillerson appointment, Perry being a guy who said we should abolish the Department of Energy, and also the likelihood of John Bolton now being named Deputy Secretary of State, who is, I suppose you could call him a far-right ideologue. He is. Jim Garrity?
That's not necessarily the first word that would come to my mind when it comes to describing it, but fine. For everyone who's going to be, you know, tearing their hair out about Tillerson's lack of traditional experience in the world of diplomacy, well, then you've got somebody like Ambassador Bolton, who's a former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. It kind of feels like there's this constantly shifting crisis. Listen, Bob, I agreed to do this till 12:25, and I think I have another call coming in right now. But basically, look, if you want an experience in diplomacy, you got John Bolton. It may not be your choice, but it seems like the criteria keep shifting around here. I hate to cut this short, but I'm going to
have you have to go to another call, and I appreciate you being with us. Jim Garrity, again, is senior political correspondent for National Review. But let's look at the Bolton record as we come up on a break here. I mean, we're talking about using language like right-wing ideologue may not seem all that advisable or wise, but in 1994, he was responsible for freezing North Korea on plutonium, for getting rid of that. He was pro the Iraq invasion. He was pro bombing Iran and the nuclear facility. I mean, go through the whole list here, opposition to the Iran agreement. I think I've got seconds left with you here, Margaret Tolliver. You want to comment on that, on that appointment of Bolton?
I think he comes to the table with a more controversial record that will promise fireworks in the confirmation process. But from Donald Trump's perspective, that may not matter as much if it makes Tillerson look like a more mainstream, acceptable candidate to everybody. Then he wins, and if Bolton is confirmed, then he wins.
Thank you, Margaret Tolliver. Well, cogent and well put. White House correspondent for Bloomberg. We're going to continue with Antonio Juhas, who's here with us in studio. We're also going to hear from somebody from the Cato Institute. We want to hear from you. If you would like to add your 2 cents or join the program, you can do so at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. President-elect Donald Trump has chosen ExxonMobil Chief Executive Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. Democrats and some Republicans, including South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, have expressed concern about Tillerson's close ties with Russian President Vladimir Putin. And we're looking at Tillerson's record, his likelihood of confirmation, and what his selection signals about a Trump foreign policy, as well as the relevance to environmental policy. And we also are talking about the appointments of John Bolin, which we got to at the last half of that last part of that last first segment, and also of Rick Perry as Energy Secretary. Margaret Tolliver was with us from Bloomberg, and we also had Jim Garrity from the National Review. Antonio Juhas is here for the hour with us, investigative journalist and author of The Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide. She's in studio. And Emma Ashford is a research fellow with the Cato Institute, focusing on the politics and foreign policies of petrostates, especially in Russia and the Middle East. And I want to speak with her briefly here. Welcome to the program, Emma Ashford.
Thanks for having me.
And let me remind you, the listeners, that you can join us a number of ways. You can either call us at our toll-free number and join in the program by bringing the phone to bear. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Or email us, forum@kqed.org. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And you can also go to our website, kqed.org/forum. We do welcome your comments and your questions. And Emma Ashford, we want to get you on here because you're not entirely 100% in favor of this nomination, but you think some of the criticism of lack of diplomatic experience is perhaps not necessarily thought through because, as we said earlier, Exxon is kind of a sovereign state unto itself, and certainly Tillerson has a lot of foreign policy experience in that sense.
Yeah, I think a lot of this criticism has focused on the fact that Tillerson really has no sort of governmental foreign policy experience. But if you were going to pick someone from the business world to fill the shoes of Secretary of State, you could do a lot worse than Tillerson. He has been running ExxonMobil for a number of years, and in that capacity, he has been involved intimately in negotiations with a variety of states around the world, trying to achieve Exxon's goals in those states. And so even though he's not had experience with diplomacy as a sort of a member of government, he has been involved in exactly the same process on the private sector side.
And what about the, from your perspective, the ties to Russia? I mean, he did receive the Order of Friendship given to him by Vladimir Putin back in 2013. He clearly has had very close ties with Russia and wanted the sanctions to be lifted because he wants to get along with the pumping in Siberia, which could mean potentially billions of dollars.
Yeah, this is an interesting complaint that we're hearing, particularly from some of the congressional GOP, which is interesting that Tillerson is close friends with Vladimir Putin, that he was given a medal by Putin, and this is something we should be very concerned about. Again, I'm a little less concerned about that from that point of view. I think a number of Americans have been given that honor by the Russian government. I think Tillerson has good relations with the Russian government, but that's a necessary part of his goal in achieving Exxon's goals inside Russia, in being able to cooperate with Russian companies. Where I think it starts to become more of a problem is when we start to talk about conflicts of interest. So will Tillerson, who will still have stock options in Exxon, who will still have some sort of interest in seeing the company succeed, will he be able to put aside some of these positions like immediately lifting of sanctions or closer cooperation with the Russian government if they don't fit U.S. national security needs?
And what are your thoughts about John Bolton being appointed, which is in all likelihood fait accompli? I mean, he said that the hacking charges against Russia are nothing but a false flag.
I think it's very concerning. I mean, there are many, many reasons to be concerned about John Bolton backing government. The recent comments are perhaps among the least of them. Certainly, it does no one any good for him to start suggesting that branches of the U.S. government can't be trusted or that they have become part of, you know, the diplomatic establishment. That's all very concerning. But John Bolton's record going back 10, 20 years, particularly his pivotal role during the first Bush administration, the second Bush administration, I think are also really concerning. We heard a lot of talk during the campaign about how Trump would be very isolationist, very restrained in his foreign policy. But if we look at his appointments, John Bolton is just the latest example of someone that is extremely hawkish.
Again, Emma Ashford is research fellow with Cato Institute, and she focuses on politics and foreign policies of petrostates, especially in Russia and the Middle East. Let me go right to your calls here, and let's go first to Napa and welcome Pam. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I always appreciate your show. I'd like to make a point, a larger point, that the GOP folks and businessmen are always complaining about the government being too big and too many regulations. Well, here's a playbook for how to destroy a government department. Appoint an unqualified person to head it up who is unsympathetic to the goals of that department.
Well, there is some wonder being expressed throughout our land about these appointments and what we are to make of them. Let me thank you for that call, Pam. Glad to have your opinion here. I mean, especially when you appoint someone like Ben Carson to head up housing, and he has no experience in government, let alone with housing, or Rick Perry, who, as I said, wanted to abolish the Department of Energy and has had experience as a governor, but certainly not on the national level. And Tillerson, again, running Exxon, but no governmental experience. And in many people's eyes, too close to Russia, maybe even hostile, where those who are concerned about the environment. Let me read some of your comments, and I'll go to more of your calls. Joel writes, Trump is a reality TV show host presenting pro-business millionaires to roll back 50 years of progressive laws. I mean, that's what Make America Great Again means. Tom emails, our country is in a deep freeze. There is no man-made global warming. This is junk science. Trump's cabinet selections make me sleep better at night. So we're getting, again, all kinds of opinions here, and yours are welcome as well. You can email them to us, forum@kqed.org, or go on the record by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle's @kqedforum. And let me go to more callers. Peter joins us next. Peter, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to point out, if it hasn't already been pointed out already, I mean, the entire reason for the existence of the Department of Energy, really, when you get down to it, is nuclear weapons. That's what it's for. Everything else is ancillary in support of that. You could ask why it's not called the Department of Nuclear Weapons, but that's another question. I think it's really alarming to have somebody put in charge of that who argues that we ought to get rid of it, because the only plausible explanation for that is he has absolutely no clue what the Department of Energy is actually for. So that's all I wanted to say.
All right, and I'm glad you said it. I thank you for it. Getting some listener opinions here. Let me go next to David in Sonoma. David, welcome.
Yes. You know, this guy Trump, he's a professional two-stepper. All you got to do is don't listen to a word this guy says. Just look at who he puts around him. That'll tell you the direction they're going in. Now, you got this guy, Tillerson, and he's going to divorce Chevron, Michael, like you're going to divorce journalism. Now, with these elections, I don't know if you remember Todd and Bob Rosevich, the two guys that control the Diebold and the election systems. But, you know, these elections that we have, all of the voting is privately counted. Now, what does that tell you about how these voting machines, which was proven at the University of Michigan back in 2001, that it takes about 2 minutes, and that's it, to go ahead and hack these voting machines that we have in our country and flip the vote?
All right, David, we're getting off on another topic there, but I thank you for the call. We'll hear from more listeners in just a moment. I want to go back, if I may, Emma Ashford, to you. Emma Ashford with the Cato Institute specializes in Russia and the Middle East. George asks, what would Tillerson's position on Syria be given his ties to Russia? Cooperation with Russia against ISIS?
This is the interesting thing about Tillerson as a Secretary of State appointment. I don't know, and I'm not sure anyone knows what his stance would be on Syria, what his stance would be on almost any foreign policy issue outside of sanctions on Russia. That's the one area in which we're fairly sure we know what Tillerson's opinions are, but there's actually very little out there. He's never really spoken on foreign policy issues. We have no idea what sort of stance he takes on foreign policy. Is he hawkish? Is he not? Does he want to cooperate more with U.S. allies or not? Does he want to work with international institutions or outside them? All of this is an open question, perhaps even more so with Tillerson than it has been with any of Trump's other appointments.
Well, let me go back to you on this, Antonia Juhas, here in studio, author of The Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide. There was the beginning of what was called a reset with Russia when Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State. There seems to be a reset with Russia going on right now, the hacking notwithstanding, as far as Trump is concerned. And you would presume that his Secretary of State, who has close ties to Putin and Russia, would be probably all on Russia's side, which means on Assad's side.
That's quite probable. I mean, I think we need to just unpack a little more specifically these ties to Russia. So Exxon is a massive holder of oil around the world. Of course, its first largest holdings are in the United States. Its second largest holdings are in Russia. That is because of Tillerson and the deals that he has been making with Russia, which other than his purchase of XTO Energy in the United States are his largest, you know, sort of crown on his head. But he can't get to them. He has this massive pool of oil that he needs to be able to book to support ExxonMobil moving forward, which has seen its profits decline by 50% year end over year end. And one of the biggest problems that Exxon has is what's called its reserve replacement ratio. It's pulling out too much oil compared to what it's got in the ground. Well, it has oil in the ground. It's in Russia, in the Arctic, but it can't get to it and it can't book it. Massive, potentially hundreds of billions of dollars worth of oil because of the sanctions, which is why Tillerson made so many visits to the White House to lobby to get the sanctions removed. Now, when Tillerson's name first came out as Secretary of State, my first thought was, why would he take that appointment? He has so much influence and such a long history of influence on public policy as the CEO of Exxon, which I can go off on for an hour if you'd like me to, but there's a track record there.
Don't have the time, sorry.
Too bad. Okay. But so what we know is that one of the foreign, so I was, why would he take this position? He's had such great influence on foreign policy thus far. So the first answer was, he's retiring next year, so he has to go do something else. But the second answer was this Russia deal. He's tried over and over again to get the White House to change its policy. I do not believe that big oil trusts Trump and its administration. And the best way to exercise that influence is from inside. And that's what Tillerson is trying to do. And Russia is one piece of that equation, but it's not the only piece. Exxon has interests all over the world. These are not diplomatic interests. These are corporate interests. Tillerson is going to have almost 30 million shares of Exxon when he retires. Most of them are deferred over a decade. He spent his entire life at this company. He's deeply financially tied to this company.
He may have to sell those shares, though, if he's going to be confirmed.
But what about the deferred shares? So, you know, I just can't be convinced that he doesn't even personally believe that Exxon's interests are, in fact, America's interests. I, of course, personally disagree.
Well, there was a New York Times editorial yesterday that said that with the appointment of Tillerson and also Michael Flynn, and I suppose one could add a couple of other names, we seem to have pro-Russia apologists. Emma Ashford, you would disagree with that?
Well, I think certainly if we're going to talk about Michael Flynn, people think he's very pro-Russian, but actually if you go and read his book, which he co-authored with Michael Ledeen, you actually find a very harsh take on Russia and a very hard stance on Russia. And, you know, he disapproves of further cooperation. So I think he's been becoming a little more conciliatory as he's kind of entered the Trump transition team's orbit on Russia. But he's definitely not seeking necessarily to build better relations with Russia. But looking more broadly at the transition team and the appointments that Trump is building around him, the one common, two common threads. One is conflicts of interest. But the second is that they are somewhat more conciliatory towards Russia. And in some ways, this is a good thing, right? Because the relationship with Russia has reached pretty much the lowest point it's been since the end of the Cold War under the Obama administration, and trying to improve that, because there's areas where we really do need to cooperate with Russia. Trying to improve that can be a good thing. The problem is that many of these people seem to be suggesting that we can improve that relationship with Russia simply by giving Russia everything it wants, by cooperating with it in Syria, by lifting
Well, by also going against NATO and perhaps closing or turning a blind eye when it comes to expansion in places like Ukraine or Crimea. I mean, there's a lot at stake here, and we haven't even broached the whole topic of what A Tillerson appointment might mean in Asia, for example, with respect to North Korea specifically, and, of course, South China Sea and the rest of it. There is a lot that's involved here. But let me bring another caller on here, and let's get to you, Frank, in Mill Valley. You're on.
Good morning. I agree with it was a very concise description of his conflicts of interest. I thought that was very nice. And I despise all these appointments, but isn't it time for us to stop hand-wringing and to see if there is some sort of coalition that can be achieved that will actually defeat any of these candidates? And so my question to the group that's currently there is, does anybody believe, let's start with Tillerson, who, if Jim Gary believes somebody's vulnerable, then he may well be. But do any of you folks see any of these people getting knocked down? And if so, what can the Democrats do to increase the chances of that?
Well, both of our political correspondents are gone now, but you want to speculate a little bit on this, Antonio Yuhas?
I think there's definitely a strong pushback, and at a minimum, we're going to see a very aggressive hearing. Exxon is currently under investigation by the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, both for potentially lying to its shareholders about what it knew about climate change and what it did and did not do about climate change, but also the way that it books its reserves. And that's not even, you know, looking at Russia and all the many other conflicts of interest. And if all of the Democrats hold together, and if just three Republicans, and we've already named three who could be those three Republicans, voted against Tillerson could go down. And I think at a minimum, there's certainly the opportunity for the public to express its concerns and to let those concerns be known to our elected representatives and to make sure that these hearings expose what we know about Tillerson moving forward. And, you know, these
one should add elected representatives outside of the Northern California region, because I think all of them are probably going to be in opposition.
That's
we
true.
Don't have many Republicans in this region. I'm looking at a comment by Owen apropos of Frank's call, who says, a friend of mine in the Justice Department told me that during the Bush-Cheney years, a kind of resistance was carried on by small acts of sabotage, misdirected memos, forgotten assignments, et cetera, that together mitigated the damaging policies of the attorneys general and the White House. I hope that the same kind of quiet resistance will have the same effect in many cabinet departments. It was a subversive thought, but let me go to more of your calls. Let me go next to Greg. Greg, you're on.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for the conversation. I just want to say, you know, it's really disturbing to me that, you know, again, the press is going off on all these side shoot issues, which, you know, I think are very important. It is very alarming to me about the connection with Russia. But, you know, this election was about the working poor and, you know, the disconnection between the Democratic Party and that class of people. And here we are again, letting Trump kind of steer us away from all of that and appoint people that have absolutely no connection to the working class.
Point well taken, and thank you for it. I'm also looking at a point here, and maybe, Emma Ashford, you can give us some light on this. A listener wants to know, is there anyone in the Trump cabinet who is not a climate change denier?
Well, I think with Tillerson, you actually have to acknowledge that over the last decade or more, he's actually been fairly instrumental in changing policy on climate change issues and on bringing them more into the mainstream of this discussion.
So we mentioned that before you joined us. We talked about the fact that he agrees with the Paris Agreement and carbon tax and believes in climate change. But who else in the cabinet believes in climate change at this point? Do we know?
To be honest, I'm not sure. So I've been focusing mostly on the foreign policy appointments, and over on that side, almost nobody focuses on energy policy or on energy security. So it's kind of hard to say, and I assume that if the people at the very top of the Trump administration decide that they're going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement or take a much harder line on climate issues, that they'll just follow along with that.
And we go next to Ed. Ed, thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, I just want to make a comment that the Trump administration is basically might as well be Koch brothers administration. If you look at who he is putting in charge in Department of Education, Department of Energy, and now Secretary of State, plus all these other cabinet appointments, these are really people who are pushing the agenda for Koch brothers. The other thing also is that here's my prediction, okay? There is going to be another war in the Middle East, because if you stop the flow of oil to the Gulf, the price of oil will jump, which benefits Russia, which benefits Exxon, and which meant his oil companies. Last time we had an old person in charge, that was Dick Cheney, and we had a war. The last thing I want to say is Tatum Institute was actually created by the Koch brothers. They wrote the policies for the Koch brothers going into the States. You might have as well brought a guest from the Russian embassy to, you know, represent the administration and the policies of what is going on.
Well, thank you for bringing up the Koch brothers, although they were not contributors to the Donald Trump campaign. That's on the record. But I'm wondering about Ed's bringing up the Middle East here again. And Emma Ashford, let me go to you. When we look at Tillerson's record, we see, for example, he cut a deal with the Kurdish national government and undermined the Iraqi government under Malachi. And that was something that was criticized very strongly by particularly those who wanted a unified Iraq, even though it was pretty much a Shiite Iraq. How do you think this is all going to play out in the Middle East? I mean, here we have this last caller talking about predicting skyrocketing oil prices and also possibly war.
Well, I think Tillerson is going to be interesting Secretary of State to see whether he can shift from this very profit-oriented motive to actually talking about national security. And the case you highlight in Iraq is one of those cases where he directly undermined U.S. national security interests in Iraq by going around the central government in Baghdad and going to the Kurds. And there's a lot of areas where the difference between things that Tillerson has done as CEO of Exxon and things that the U.S. government has advocated are really quite different. And so he has great relations with lots of these leaders, but how is it going to work out in the long run when he starts having to criticize them for their human rights violations, for example, or having to work opposite them rather than working with them to enrich both sides? So I think that's going to be a very big problem for him in trying to reorient his perspective.
Let me go back to Antonio Juhas, who again is here in studio with us, author of The Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide. Interested to hear your thoughts again about cutting a deal with the Kurds. But before I go to that, let me get this out again, and I've mentioned it before, that we have prominent names, you know, very distinguished names like Robert Gates and James Baker and Condoleezza Rice pushing this nomination. How much are we to make of the fact, in your judgment, that, well, Baker's law firm has represented Exxon on a number of occasions, and Rosneft, as I mentioned before. But the other two, both Gates and Condoleezza Rice, have worked directly for Exxon through the international consulting firm that they formed. Should we make a great deal of this, or is it just simply part of the package?
Well, there's deep ties here, and they go way back. But one of the places where they are important is that Exxon spent more money than it ever spent on any previous election getting Bush and Cheney elected and into office, and longtime backers of Bush and the Bush family. And Lee Raymond, Tillerson's predecessor, was one of the key parties of the Cheney Energy Task Force. He was a key player in development of U.S. energy policy in Iraq leading up to and after the war. Exxon was with its Russian partner, was one of the key beneficiaries of that war, winning the West Guarna oil field, one of the largest oil fields on the planet in Iraq following the invasion, and which it continues to profit from. And then on Kurdistan, it, you know, went on its own and said, we're going to go ahead and make this deal.
Like I said earlier, like a sovereign state.
And we're going to go ahead and make the deal that we want to make because, you know, Cheney isn't our guy anymore and it's the Obama administration. So we're going to go in and do what we want to do. And they did. And those ties are financial, they're political, they're social. If you look at Steve Cole's book on Exxon, Private Empire, you know, one of the things he really successfully highlights is this Republican, conservative, white male ethos within Exxon. And one of the ways that that has played out is, you know, even the oil industry, which itself is deeply invested, you know, much more disproportionately invested in Republicans, Exxon is, you know, even beyond the average and usually goes into the 80-90% of its giving going to Republicans. That said, big oil on the whole, a good deal of its money went to Clinton in this election because they just saw Trump as this unknown
wild card.
Yeah. And that's, again, one of the reasons why I think that Tillerson himself is moving into the administration to see the policies he wants implemented.
Well, let me read a tweet from Carl who says, I may not like Tillerson, but he's superbly qualified. Business on the global scale requires extensive geopolitical, economic, and cultural knowledge. And that's going to be obviously an argument you're going to hear up on the Hill when the hearings take place. But here's Walt who says, I heard on CNBC yesterday that Tillerson will not have to pay taxes on his stock if he were to take the Secretary of State job due to a tax law that is supposed to encourage public service. Any truth to that? Do you know, Emma Ashford?
I'm afraid I don't know about that. I do know that Tillerson should divest or should and is meant to divest himself of most of those stock options if he really wants to be confirmed. We've seen public servants do that before. I think most notably Hank Paulson, when he became Secretary of the Treasury, he divested himself of his stock. Whether or not Tillerson will feel the need to do that in a Trump administration where conflicts of interest are being treated as not really an important factor, I think we don't know yet.
I still say we could know a lot if we were to see, in terms of Russia and ties to Russia, if we could see the tax returns of Donald Trump, but we may never, of course, have that opportunity. Where is Tillerson on Keystone? Do you know, Antonia?
Certainly an advocate of Keystone. And of course, granting pipelines that move beyond U.S. borders, that move between international borders, is purview of Secretary of State. I just want to say before we end, this idea that energy policy is somehow separate from working Americans and the needs of working Americans, you know, unions in the oil and gas sector and the coal sector even threw all of their support behind Hillary Clinton because they knew that the policies towards workers of Trump and his advisors are aggressively anti-worker, anti-worker protection. And harming clean air harms public health, which harms all of us.
And again, Antonia Juhas joined us for the hour, investigative journalist and author of The Tyranny of Oil and Black Tide. We thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Emma Ashford, research fellow with Cato Institute. Appreciate your
thank
being
you.
With us. And we also want to extend thanks to Margaret Tolliff, who joined us earlier, White House correspondent for Bloomberg, and Jim Garrity, who is senior political correspondent for National Review. And you can continue this discussion online simply by going to kqed.org/forum. We encourage you to do that. And we encourage you to stay tuned for another hour of Forum. We're going to talk about the rental and home buying market here in the Bay Area, which has gone through perhaps some changes and maybe changing, well, even while we're speaking here. Stay tuned for that. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.